Greetings, everyone. This is Brian Reisman, host of Side Jams, a proud member of the Pantheon Podcast Network. Please subscribe and follow the show on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. And also know that it is now available as a video podcast on YouTube, starting with episode 56. It's video onward, but you can also listen to the audio portion right here. I hope you enjoy this latest episode. Hey everybody, it's Brian Reisman, host of Side Jams. This is episode number 57, featuring Buzz Osborne from The Melvins. This is the second video podcast. I hope you enjoyed. If you like what you see in here, click on that subscribe button down below, because there are more episodes coming. Now, The Melvins are a very influential band on a lot of people in the metal and grunge world. They have a new two-disc acoustic set called Five-Legged Dog, in which they rework a lot of songs in their catalog, 54 in total, I believe. Now, this is not the sensitive James Taylor singer-songwriter version of The Melvins. They're still dark and brooding and moody, and at times aggressive. Now, when Buzz is not on stage or in the studio making noise and making music, he loves photography, golfing, and comic books. And we're going to get into all of those things right now. Thank you for taking the time to chat.
Thank you.
I'm enjoying the Five-Legged Dog. You couldn't just do one acoustic disc. You had to do four albums. And I'm new to the Melvins universe, but it's very obvious to me that, like, you didn't want to do, we're going to do a soft kind of sensitive interpretation of material. We're just going to see how heavy we can get. Still in an acoustic format, you know?
Yeah. I mean, a long time ago, I got turned on to this record, probably 40 years ago, by a live record that Pete Townsend was a part of, the guitar player from The Who.
Yeah.
He did three songs. He did on acoustic. He did Won't Get Fooled Again, Pinball Wizard, and Drown.
Mm.
And it was then, because I was such a big fan of them, I got that record and I listened to that acoustic, his acoustic versions, and they were just as powerful as the band would have been. And I realized that the songs are good no matter what, no matter how you do it. And I never lost that idea through this record. And I did two solo acoustic records with that in mind and always wanted to. But him and probably Pete Townsend and Bob Dylan, solo acoustic, especially the early 60s stuff or the mid 60s stuff, like It's All Right, Mom, Only Bleeding, just show how heavy you can do. Or a lot of blues artists as well, how heavy you can do stuff like that. And it doesn't really make much difference if the songs are good. So I thought, out of all of our catalog, there's a lot of songs that we could probably do like that to make it work. And the guys I play with are really good musicians. And
yeah.
You just let them do their job.
Well, I think the interesting thing is that you've mentioned that you've recorded, you started writing a lot of these songs on acoustic guitar.
Always have.
Yeah.
And electric guitar played acoustically.
Yeah. But I mean, I think that's the key to good music is coming up with something that will, you know, that'll work in different formats. I mean, obviously it's interesting. I remember years, I think there's someone on YouTube who commented, you know, back in the late 90s, someone said we should have a Melvins acoustic record. And then it only took 25 years. And then I remember in the early to mid 90s, one critic said, what we really want to hear is a Motorhead unplugged album. I mean, you guys both have old school influences. Your Amoeba video where you and the guys, you know, and Dale, you go and you show everything that you bought. You guys are old school. I mean, you like newer stuff.
Yeah, as well as new school.
Yeah.
I mean, I like about as many new bands as I ever did, which is not many.
Yeah.
You know?
But you appreciate things like the Rolling Stones, and you're not afraid to say that, whereas like some fans might be like, oh, whatever. You're like, no, really, dude, it's good.
I'm not an ageist when it comes to music. You know, it's either good or bad. When I was in high school, bands like the Stones and Hendrix and The Who were not of my generation, just like Pete Townsend said, you know, but I loved it nonetheless.
Yeah.
I mean, I always think it's silly when people will write off, you know, like young people, they just don't listen to this. It's like, that's just not true. Not all young people are that stupid. A lot of them are, you know?
So now, you know, obviously with Side Jams, I talk about the music being, I also talk about people's passions, their outside hobbies.
Yeah.
And Monica was telling me you're a big golfer.
Yeah, I love playing golf. I also love photography.
Oh, right on. Both. Yeah, that's a popular one too. I mean, like what attracted you to the sport?
Some guys that I knew were playing golf, rock and rollers, these people, more on the hipster level. Not people I hung out with a lot, but I knew them enough to go.
Right.
When they asked me, do you want to go try playing golf? I was like, oh, okay, that sounds fun. I think I played it once or twice in high school when I was drunk. And then I played with this friend of mine who who had given me this ancient set of clubs that looked like they came over on the Mayflower. You know? And so I had those clubs just gathering dust in the garage. And these guys asked me, and I said, okay. And I went to this little tiny course. It's not too far from where I live in LA. And it's like a par three course, 9 holes.
Right.
And I played with them. And I was like, you know, this is kind of fun. And so then I continued playing there. And within a couple of weeks, I was playing way better than they were. And I was looking at a lot of stuff on YouTube about how to do it. And what I realized was that this was not going to be an easy thing to do.
Right.
At all. And I was up for the challenge, as far as that's concerned. So within a couple of weeks, I was playing way better than they were. And within a couple of months, all of them had quit playing, except for one guy who I still, like 15 years later, still play with once in a while, who is about the same level he was when we started, because he just never took it seriously.
So, know? So were they just were that into it? Were they discouraged by your mastery of the sport so early?
Well, it's by degrees. It's like, I didn't take much to be better than them,
yeah.
You know, but it's not easy. And so, you know, within a couple of months, people just, if they don't get good at it right away, it's sort of like guitar playing.
Yeah.
People, if they don't get good at it within the first couple of months, they just put the guitar down. Most people just put the guitar down. That's the end of it. And they may fuck around a little bit, but in order to get good at anything that's as hard as guitar playing or playing golf, you have to put a lot of time in it. There's just no way. So I view golf as a massive hobby of mine.
Sure.
That I'm super into it. And as a musician, who are people of the great indoors, generally speaking,
yeah.
it's a great thing for me to do. It gets me outside on a big course. It's about a 4 or 5 mile walk. It's basically in a nice park to some degree. And it gets me out of my head and into this thing obsessively.
Sure.
That takes me completely into a whole new world that I can put my intense, never stopping brain towards, you know. And at this point, I'm like a single digit handicap. So as far as golf is concerned, which is difficult to do. I don't know how much you know about golf.
Although a little bit, I was looking, revisiting a lot of the terminology. You know, I was always one of those guys that did goofy golf, you know, miniature golf, which probably drives real golfers up a wall.
I know it's fun to some degree. I mean, I don't know that I would pursue it. Golf is hard enough as it is.
Oh yeah. When I was a kid, I did Little League. I did baseball three summers in a row. I did soccer one semester in high school, but I didn't like constantly being kicked in the shins. You know, I would play tennis or volleyball, stuff like that as I got older. But then again, as a writer, it's like what you're talking about, musicians. I became like that guy that, you know, does a lot of stuff indoors. You go to screenings, you go to shows. During quarantine, I was able to adjust pretty well for the first, probably throughout 2020. Then it started to get weird even for me. Did you golf at all during
the whole thing? As soon as they opened the courses up back in LA, I never stopped. I'm usually going on tour doing 80 to 120 shows a year.
Yeah.
And so during that time I don't golf at all. And this time I didn't have that. So I'm playing the best golf I've ever played by far, you know, as far as like my game goes.
Yeah.
And now I'm at a level where I play in tournaments and all kinds of things like that with a bunch of squares. People who are not from the music world at all. And I've made lots of friends in the golf world that have nothing to do with music at all. And what we have in common is an intense love of golf. And people, they have this idea that, oh, it's this country club assholes. And it's like, okay, if I'm doing it, do I look like a country club asshole, or that I want to be a country club asshole, or that I could mix easily with these people? I hate them every bit as much as anyone does outside of that. I want nothing to do with them. The only thing that's good about a country club is their golf courses, but the people that are there and the vibe, I want nothing to do with.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm a public course, muni course guy, and I will live that. I'll be fine with that the rest of my life. I have no interest in rubbing elbows with those fucking jerks, and nor do I want to try to pursue that in any way. So people need to understand that. Golf is a single person sport. It's like you win or lose as a result of your own ability, not a team sport.
Right, right.
And you have to win. That means you have to finish. It's not like you can run the clock out on this or throw a dice and it happens to come up all sixes or whatever. You win. Wow, you won. No, you have to finish. It doesn't matter if you're having the round of your life by hole 17. If you don't finish hole 18 under those circumstances, then that doesn't really make any difference. It's sort of like baseball or tennis. Tennis is a team sport, but baseball, you have to win. You didn't lose because you didn't have the same opportunity as the other team.
Yeah, yeah.
You lost because you just couldn't do it. Golf, you lost because you couldn't do it, not because you didn't have an opportunity. Tennis, you lose because you didn't, you know, you had exact opportunities as the other guy did, and it didn't work out. That's the kind of thing. I've always loved sports. What I didn't like was the people who played sports.
You know, I say that too. It's like I sports culture kind of turned me off to a lot of sports. Like I'm not obsessively watching sports. It's funny that my girlfriend will say, yeah, we don't watch sports together, but except when we go to like a bar or restaurant, we're sitting at the bar and then you start watching football on TV and you can't. It's like, it's funny because I don't pay attention, but then when the game is there, I start watching it, you know?
Yeah. Well, no, baseball's one. I like the non-clock sports personally, like baseball.
Yeah.
That I can watch. But clock sports, I don't like the clock as a weapon. I don't like it as a strategy.
Oh, that's interesting.
It bothers me.
In golf, of course, the only clock you have is the people behind you waiting for you to take your shot.
Yeah. Right? And so, you know, there's rules about that too.
Yeah.
Like in a place where I play tournaments, you have to, your group has to finish within 20 minutes of the group ahead of you or you get penalized.
Oh, that's interesting.
You know, so you have to keep, and just basic ethics on a golf course. You should try to stay one stroke ahead of the group behind you and one stroke behind the group ahead of you. That's what you should try to do. You should be aware of that. I'm often mystified by people on a golf course who are, or even driving, who are not aware of anything that's going on around them.
Mm.
And I often think, what sort of parents did you have?
You know, they should have been unaware. Thinking about your future in golf.
Yeah, while driving to the golf course, you're totally unaware what's going on. While you're on the golf course, you're totally unaware what's going on. It's fascinating to me that you can be that. It's my world and everyone else is just, I don't care about.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
It's unbelievable. I'm never like that. When I'm on the course, I have good course ethics and watch out. And I want to play the sport in a way that is as high a level as I can. You know, obviously, I'm not anywhere near pro, but right. To get to a single digit handicap is difficult for any golfer. Any golfer that could shoot under 100 is doing much better than most of them. And if you can shoot in the 80s, you're doing way better than most of them. If you can shoot a lot of rounds in the 70s, you're doing tremendously better, but you're still not on a pro level.
What's the best score you've ever gotten on a course?
74.
74.
On a 72 course. Yeah. That's pretty good. That's
yeah. When did you start playing tournaments and which tournaments have you played?
I played tournaments in Los Angeles in like a golf club that has three or 400 guys in it. And the tournaments are usually 70 to 120 guys. And so you play to your handicap. And the last one I played in, I got second. So
nice.
Not too bad. So I like, and you're playing PGA rules. It's not slosh golf or, you know, mulligans or, you know, do-overs. It's none of that. You're playing just the same rules as Tiger Woods would play in a tournament. And so to go out there and do it on that level and happily place in the top three, which I've done lots and lots of times, not every time, but lots and lots of times, is far more than I could have imagined I would have been able to do when I first started. So I feel comfortable on any golf course playing with anyone under any circumstances, which is far more than I would have ever thought. When I originally started, it was just going to be a fun thing to do. And now I've moved way beyond that. I mean, golf to me is fun. I like all the aspects of it, putting, chipping, all of it. I like all of it. I think it's all important. I don't find any part of golf to be easy to do. And I feel very, 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 very satisfied when I do well doing it. It feels like a massive accomplishment mentally and physically, as far as that's concerned. And the mental aspect of it, just like anything else, is a massively important thing. And people don't really take that seriously, but I think I walk off a golf course far more relaxed than when I walk onto it. You have to be, or it's not going to work. I think it's a really good thing to do. I think people should take it seriously and go out there and play as good as you can. You know, it's not a social event for me. Not at all. I play a really odd way. I have a really odd way of playing golf.
Which is what?
Excuse me?
Which is what? Like, how is it odd?
Normally you carry 14 clubs. I carry 9. Mm-hmm. I have a weird way of playing in that I dumb it down in a lot of ways that people that don't, they wouldn't really teach you to do. Sort of akin to the way Jimi Hendrix is considered the best guitar player by in a lot of areas, but there isn't one single thing that he does guitar playing wise that any teacher would ever teach you because it's so outside the box.
Interesting.
But he's the best, you know, but no one would ever teach you to do it the way he does, which to me is insane. It's like, if he's the best, wouldn't you teach people to play the way he plays? But that they're too conservative. Golfers are too conservative. Guitar players are some of the most conservative people on the face of the planet. If you try to get them to do something left or center, you're out, that's just not going to happen.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. It never made any sense to me. I never understood it. By and large, I never took guitar lessons. I never really took golfing lessons either. And so far, so good. You know,
now there's a term that I looked up, explosion shot in golf. I guess that's when you're stuck in a sand trap.
Explosion shot, yeah.
Yeah. What's the craziest shot you've had to take on a golf course?
Oh, name it. You know, under a tree with in mud. Just crazy, weirdest things you can imagine. You just do your best. There's books written about that stuff, you know.
There's what?
About how to get out of trouble. Whole books written about how to get out of trouble. And you have to practice that to some degree and you just realize what will work. Mm-hmm. The best thing. It's like is like if you're in trouble, the next shot, no matter what it is, should be designed to get you out of trouble. Doesn't mean it's going to be, you know, advancing towards the green on a 300-yard shot. It doesn't mean any of that. It means get yourself out of this trouble that you're in, no matter what. That's the thing. And a lot of people don't want to look at it that way. I got to try to hit it between these trees as far forward as I can. Well, maybe. But maybe the best thing for you to do is to get yourself out of this mess. It's like if you're in a bunker, the main objective is to get it out of the bunker, no matter what, no matter how you have to do it, just get it out. Doesn't matter. So when you start thinking along those lines, you're going to have an easier go of it.
What's your favorite club?
Golf club?
Yeah.
My wedge, probably. Yeah. Wedge is for short shots. That's the one I use the most, probably. It's a pitching wedge. I use it for everything.
Right.
Every short shot. I only carry 2 wedges, which is really odd. Most people have a lot of them. One's higher loft than the other one. But I have an odd way of approaching all of that stuff too. Most of which, even if people see the results, they don't believe it because it's too outside the box for them. Same with putting and all those kinds of things. I have my own weird way of doing all that and it's successful. It's nothing anyone would ever teach, that's for sure, because it looks odd.
I'm sensing an instructional video, the King Buzzo way.
You know, the thing is I have shown people, you know, they go, oh, you're amazing chipping. Your chipping is amazing. Your putting is really good. And when you show them what you do, they don't want to do it. They don't believe it.
Is it like just an odd posture, or is they just feel it's too much work? What's their deal?
It's less work. It's far less work.
Really?
Like they just can't get outside this idea that the way they have to do it is the way Tiger Woods or Phil Mickelson or any of these, that's how they do it.
Jack Nicklaus, I remember him growing up.
It's like, what is the point of golf? It's scoring the lowest score you can. It doesn't matter how you do it.
Yeah.
It's like you want to get the ball closer to the hole so you can put it in easier. That's it. The rest of it is just, it's immaterial how you do that.
So you break the rules of music and break the rules of golf. Do you break the rules of photography as well?
Yeah, all the time. Photography has been a passion of mine since I was a teenager. But long before digital, because I'm 57, so digital didn't come in until, you know, really in a big way, the photography till the 90s, pretty much.
Yeah. And even the 2000s is when it got more sophisticated, too. It got really good cameras.
Right. But earlier, I couldn't afford film and developing stuff. And I certainly wasn't going to have my own darkroom or anything like that.
And people don't remember that. That's what we did. I did that in film school. Yes. My dad did that as a hobby. I mean, it's a lot of work. Yeah.
And I just never had to, I loved it as much as I loved it. It was just like, great. You know, I can buy a Rolleiflex camera that I can never get film developed and I can never buy film for it. Never. You know, just. But when digital came in is really when I put all of my the aspects of photography that I loved and really put that to good use, because now I can take as many pictures as I want and stand there and look at it right now. You know, how's it look? How's it look? How's it look? Yeah. Now I don't have to sit there and do a whole bunch of where I used to have to take a picture of something in five different ways, in five different settings to try to figure out if it was going to work or not.
Yeah, yeah.
No more. Now I can sit there and nail that thing exactly how I want it and walk away. I'm definitely a street photographer. I don't think I would do really well in a studio, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I did take the cover about a year ago, take the cover of Revolver, of a picture of Mike Patton.
Nice.
So they let me do that. So it kind of proved that I could do that, which is nice. That was outside though. But street photography is my thing. I have an Instagram account, Real King Buzzo, that's solely just me showing off my photography. That's it. No pictures of me, no selfies, no pictures of me with, you know, drunk celebrities or anything like that. It's just pictures that I take. That's it. You know,
what are your favorite types of pictures to take?
Oh, it depends. You know, street photography to me is you're constantly looking for something that would be a good picture. It doesn't matter what it is. Mm-hmm. I'm constantly looking for it. An angle on it that's funny or that I think is beautiful or weird, something. And I'm constantly looking for that stuff. I just can't help it. Constantly. It doesn't matter if it's with my like regular cameras or with my phone. Mm-hmm. And iPhones take unbelievable pictures, far, far beyond what people imagine. Because, you know, if you talk to, I know plenty of people that are make their living taking pictures.
Sure. See, me too. Yeah, yeah.
You talk to them and I go, well, how much difference would it make for Man Ray if he had the equipment that they have now? And they go, minimally, it wouldn't have mattered. I mean, he could take a good picture with any camera.
Right.
Because he's a good photographer. The equipment matters very little. It's like, you know, Jimi Hendrix with the shittiest guitar out of the Ward's catalog, you know, would have still been way better than you or me, you know. It wouldn't have mattered what guitar he was playing. So you put an iPhone in the hands of Man Ray or any of those people back then, they're going to take fantastically amazing pictures with it because they're fantastically amazing photographers. People get so hung up on how did you take, what kind of camera did you, how did you take? It's the eye. It's the Indian, not the arrow.
You started off with film and an old school way of working. How do the two compare for you? Do you prefer one or the other? Do you like both?
Digital.
Hmm.
I prefer it.
Like using Photoshop, or are you more of somebody who just likes to take the photos and just tweak
them? I'm not slightly? Good at Photoshop. I'm not good at it. But it's like your dad, you know, in the dark room manipulating pictures, and people now have this thing, well, I didn't use a filter. It's like photographers have always used filters. They've always used manipulation, whether in the dark room or photo retouching. That's nothing new. Nothing new. Cropping it, editing it, all these different things that you can do. I mean, in the dark room, you could focus in on one area of the camera, of the picture, and then have that be far brighter than it. There's a million things you could do. All these things are... The things that you can do with filters, quote unquote, like on an iPad, are the same things they've been doing. They're just takeoffs of what they've always done in the darkroom.
Yeah, I mean, for you. So for you with photography, it sounds like you're sort of a shoot from the hip kind of guy. Like you just try to capture things in the moment.
Try to, and then, you know, there's some things where I'll go, I know there's a good picture here. I have to get it. I have to make it work. And but I'm not one to take 500 pictures and then try to pick out the best ones. I'll edit it right there. Hmm. Delete, 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 delete. That's the two I want.
Oh, that's interesting. So you don't keep like, see, I have a huge backlog of all these photos I've taken over the years on trips. You know, like 1,000 photos per trip. And I'm like, wow, that's a lot of stuff.
But I don't want them. You know, I just don't want them. It has to speak to me or it means nothing to me.
So you're spontaneous, but then right afterwards, you're very decisive about what it is that you like.
Absolutely. Or I'll take five pictures and look at them later and delete four of them. You know, those don't speak to me. Art is communication. That's what it is. Hmm. It doesn't communicate something unless you're just trying to take a picture of, you know, here's a picture of my mom and my brother together. You know, it doesn't have to be a good picture. It's enough to just look at them and be, you know, wonder what, you know, be happy that there's a great picture of them that you can remember forever. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that at all. And I think the cameras are great for those kinds of memory things. And I do that as well. But if I'm taking a picture that I want to use, it's more of an artistic level, then it has to communicate something. If it doesn't communicate anything to me, I don't want anything to do with it.
Yeah.
But I have a couple of pictures here, though. Let me see. Let's see where they are. I have them here somewhere. Here they are. That I really like. Here's one of, I don't know if you can see.
Sure it on my,
here's one of our drummer I took in New Orleans. That's pretty good.
Oh, yeah.
That's in New Orleans.
Looks like he's talking to someone, preparing for some sort of secret mission.
He's talking on the phone. That's right. That's a good one. Here's one I took of Jeff Pincus. He's smoking weed with a Betty Ford clinic shirt on.
Excellent. Oh, your wry sense of humor there, Buzz.
Gotta love that. Gotta love that. Let's see. Here's one I took of the singer from Le Butcherettes. That's a really good one.
All right on.
That was with an iPhone, believe it or not.
Yeah, you know, the quality, I mean, I right now I have a Galaxy and I need to upgrade. And I'm thinking, even though I'm not an Apple guy, I'm going to have to probably switch over because the quality is better on iPhones.
I think. A lot of it.
Yeah, a lot of it.
That's when I took flying over the Indian Ocean.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So it's lots of stuff like that. It's just whatever happens, you know.
Are there any images that you're most proud of? Is there something on your Instagram account now that you really love that you're very proud of?
Oh, nothing in particular. I mean, I suppose I could bring it up. Hold on. Let me look. I'll bring it up really quick and then see if there's something recently. I think I have about 500 pictures, but I only had it for a couple of years. So, I like this one. This one's really good. It's a picture I took at the, I don't know if you can see it. It's a picture I took I probably can't see it very good, but
it's interesting. Yeah.
Picture I took of a bunch of fish.
Oh, that looks like fish. Okay. It comes out. Yeah. It's black and white.
Yeah, I like black and white best.
It feels like it's a little overexposed too, like purposely. Like
it's it has to be to blow it out like that. And then this was really good. I took in Arizona.
The next frontier for Amazon to go into is that.
Yeah, Amazon Motel. I think it might be different than that. And then there's a really good one here. I took one of our dogs. It's a good one.
Oh, that's cool. You have fun with it. By the way, so what are you shooting with?
I have two Leica cameras, the cheapest ones, you know.
Oh yeah, yeah. Those are expensive cameras too. They're very high end. Those are posh.
Probably about $800 a piece.
Yeah.
C-Lux and D-Lux. Those are the ones I take the most. I didn't want anything that was big. Mm-hmm. I don't want a camera that I have to change lenses on at all.
Okay.
So both of them are zoom. I don't want anything I can't really fit in my pocket, but I want it to be a little better quality than, or easier to use than one of the normal digital ones. You know? Yeah. And these ones, I just think that they're really great and I use them all the time and they're great cameras. And I don't want some gigantic camera. It always feels obtrusive to me.
Yeah.
I'm worried about it. I don't, you know, I'm not worried about going and taking a, you know, close up picture of a silverback gorilla from 900 yards away. That's not me, you know, or a close up of a pitcher from Dodger Stadium, you know, 900, you know, that's not me either. You know, it's like anything that I can't take a picture of with this, the way that I have it, the equipment that I have, I'm not worried about. There's plenty of stuff for me to take pictures of that I'm not, that are fine with those cameras, like this, a big bucket of fish heads, you know.
Oh, there we go.
Giant bucket of fish hits. That stuff's the simplest stuff. You know, you can find stuff like that.
Melvin's album title too coming up.
What was that?
It could be a Melvin's album title, Bucket of Fish Heads.
So, certainly could be, you know. But that kind of stuff, it has to speak to me. And I'll take pictures on tour, right? Especially when I go on tour, take pictures all the time. And then
the pictures of your bandmates?
Oh, tons.
Do you ever do it live? Like just whip out the camera for the hell of it?
No, never. No, I have too much other things going on when we're playing live. I take pictures of those guys all the time. Tons and tons of pictures of them. It's just they're good sports. Stand right here. I got a good.
If you put on a timer, like Stuart Copeland did a great documentary about the police, and he took a lot.
I saw that.
It was great. Like he had a camera right behind his kit, right on stage. You got like a very different perspective of the band playing live. It was great that he documented that. Actually,
yeah.
Have you ever tried doing that at all?
That's not the one. The Andy Summers one or the Stuart Copeland.
That's the Stuart Copeland one that came out a year or two ago.
Did you see the Andy Summers one?
No, I haven't. I just interviewed him recently too for this podcast. So.
He's a huge photographer too.
Yeah, I talked to him about his fiction writing actually.
Oh, I haven't read that, but his documentary he did was called "Surviving the Police," I think.
Oh yeah.
I think. And his tons of stuff about him taking pictures in there, which is originally what got me interested in them because I always liked their stuff.
Yeah,
a great deal, but I had no idea he was a photographer, and then I found that I got to watch this documentary, and then it's really good. Really good how he did it, but I have to look. It's interesting though, what kind of stuff the cameras can do. I mean, everybody has a camera now, and there's cameras everywhere, but not everybody's a good photographer. It's like this friend of mine He goes, I've taken a picture of the exact same thing as you have at the exact same moment, and mine's not as good.
It was like, you shoot digital with yep. Leica, and then what were you shooting film-wise prior to that?
Whatever I could afford.
Yeah. Were you like a Nikon or Canon? I mean, these days, it's like Nikon.
I had a Nikon when I first started. I bought a really, really, Nikon that didn't have a light meter in it to start with.
Oh, interesting. You know, so you really had to guess. You had to get a lot of guesswork.
I didn't have a light meter. So yeah. I learned all about how to shoot into the light, burn it with the light really good.
Yeah.
Tons of stuff like that. Lots of bad pictures didn't come out. You don't know for a couple weeks till you get the pictures back, which irritates the shit out of me.
And have you ever done an exhibition of your photography?
Or no, never.
Would you like to?
I would like to. Just in the last couple of years is when I finally, first time I ever really showed anybody was just on Instagram like a couple of years ago. That's it. I never had a social media account before that. It's the only one I've ever had. And it was solely with that. And I've gotten a good response from people. And so it's not band oriented, even though I sometimes show the band.
Yeah.
Members I take pictures of, but it's not a vehicle for me to sell, our new show coming up or a new album. That's not what it's about. And which is fine. I mean, I think that's fine. We have a Melvin's account that happens on.
Sure.
But I would love to do that. I've got a book that I put together, a photography book that we're just waiting to print it. So
who's going to put it out? Is it going to be self-published?
Probably the first ones will be. We'll take it from there.
That's cool. And by the way, so you have Batman and Superman on the wall back there.
Yeah.
You're a comic book fan also, or are you just a fan of their?
I do like comic books.
Are there any things that you like to collect or read?
I collect CGC graded comics.
I want to know what the deal with that is. That's like become a big thing where comics I never thought would be worth $100 or slabbed, and suddenly, what got you into that, and why? What? How do people justify it? Because how much does it cost, first of all, to even get your comic graded?
Well, I usually buy them already graded.
Oh, okay.
I don't buy. I've gotten a few slabbed, but I don't have good luck with that. I'd rather just go, and go. This is it. 8.0.
Right.
Okay, that's what it is. Now it doesn't tell you what it's worth. It tells you what condition the book's in.
The way then you look it up, yeah.
And then you can figure out between you and the seller what you want to sell it, what you want to buy it for, which I like. And a lot of people will be like, "Well, these aren't right." Okay, if it's not right, then sell it to me as a 5.
So I guess the thing for me, like I buy stuff, I buy it to read it. So I buy readable condition a lot of times. I don't go for the very fine or near mint and stuff. So what's the appeal for you for the CGC stuff? Is it just Is it an investment?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I like the idea of having a Stan Lee signed, Hulk 181.
Okay, well, that I get. Yeah.
That I like. That's probably my favorite thing I have in my collection.
Nice.
And the idea of opening that book and reading it seems absolutely ridiculous.
So you like very collectible. I mean, that's a rare thing. To have something right. like that. So
that's it.
Which other comics do you have? Which are the CGC graded comics? Like,
well, I have a bunch. It depends on what I'm looking for. Lots of, key issue ones. I mean, lots of them. The best thing I got was right before Stan Lee died, a guy from CGC was at his house and I got him to sign. If you send it to him, he would sign anything. And because CGC has to be there for it to be certified, signed by.
Okay.
They have to be in the presence. They won't just say, if you send in, "Oh, this is signed by Stan Lee," they won't just, if you can't prove it, then it's not.
Okay.
So I got like 25 books signed by him and graded.
Wow.
Right before he died, one of which is X-Men 2, signed Damn. By him. Yeah. So stuff like that. It's like that there's no more of those, and that's it. That's it for Stan Lee signing books. And before that, people were like, "Well, it's kind of ruining the comic." I go, you're out of your mind. This is Stan Lee.
Well,
it's like getting Babe Ruth to sign it. You're going to say Babe Ruth shouldn't sign a baseball card because it's going to ruin the card?
Oh, it makes it incredibly valuable. So what stuff do you actually like to read? Do you write any newer stuff, classic stuff?
I read lots of other stuff, I'm not super interested in new comic books.
Right.
I'll collect some of the newer stuff. But mostly with the comics, if I want it, it's already going to be graded. And it's something along those lines. I'm buying the graded thing itself. for fun and collecting them like that, like Mad number one, stuff like that.
Yeah.
I want it slabbed, you know, and or my favorite Mad issue, you know, Halloween issue with, you know, done by Kelly Free, slabbed. I want that.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't want to open this book. It's like, to me, it's like, do I want to touch, you know, King Tut's mummy? No. I'm okay to look at it. Just look at it. You know, it's like, to me, these are artifacts. They're sealed in time and they will remain that way until someone cracks them open or they get, you know, burned up in a fire. And that's what attracts me to it. Probably my favorite ones to read are the EC, you know, the Vault of Horror, you know,
Tales from the Crypt. Yeah.
Those are my favorites. But I have all those in book form. You know,
well, also, so funny,
it's hardback book form.
Funny story is the guy that started reprinting those, I think the late 70s, early 80s, Russ Cochran, was the valedictorian of my father's graduating class at the University of Missouri Rolla School of Mines.
Nice.
So he was going to go into geology and instead made a ton of money on comic books.
Yeah, that's
which
great.
Which is fantastic, actually. You know,
that's great. DC's my favorite, probably.
I love that stuff, and I love the fact that Creepshow brought that sort of back in movie form, and then years later you got the series on HBO, and there were a lot of the 50s horror stuff was really transgressive. I mean, that stuff was gory. There was a little bit of sexual content, some drug use, and it was a book called The 10-Cent Plague, which is all about how essentially by 1954-55, all those comics were not banned, but the comic book industry had to create the comics code, and they had to self-censor. They had to get rid of all Mad Magazine, Mad and Panic were two of the only things that survived EC. All the crime and war and horror comics had to go. And it's amazing.
Even though they're totally moral.
Yeah, totally
all
immoral.
The EC comics are all moral. They have a moral ending.
No, they're like, they're all, a lot of them are like O. Henry stories that are really dark and effed up. I mean, that's...
In the end, the bad guy usually gets it.
Well, there you go. Well, cool. Thank you.
It was
really fun to chat.
Thanks for having me.
And... yeah, hopefully we'll chat again soon at some point. That wraps up this latest installment of Side Jams. Please join me for the next episode, which will feature Midge Ure of Ultravox fame. The new theme song for Side Jams is Rookie of the Year by Bobo Renfley, and I licensed it through Soundstripe. Thank you very much for listening and your support.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.